isn't Christianity weird? I mean, you know, yeah, it is, but not for the reasons we often think. You know, in the 21st century Western world, it's understandable. I've just seen Superman walk down. That doesn't often happen. In the 21st century Western world, people think it's weird because they think it's old, or it's out of date, or it's a bit namby-pamby, or to be a Christian, you have to live in a separate universe from the rest of life. And that isn't the reason why it's weird. It's weird because it directly challenges the ways of the world. I've been in Singapore this week because I'm part of an international parliamentary panel on freedom of religion and belief. And there were people from 40 countries, the MPs, members of parliament. And in some of the countries we were engaging with, there are serious problems. That if you are a Christian and someone crucifies you, which is happening and has happened, then tough. They can say we have freedom of religion in their constitution as long as you get the right religion. So that's what I've been dealing with this week. And I'd never been to Singapore before. And I don't know if any of you have been there or seen pictures of it. But it's hard to come to terms with because it's grown in the last few decades. And I was walking around it yesterday, in the morning for a couple of hours. And it's full of high-rise, glass, artificial light, you know, glamour. It's an amazing place. And I was trying to find a word to sum it up. And in the end, all I could think was this. It's soulless. If a place and its architecture says something about the values of the people or of that community, then there's something I think quite worrying about what lies behind, particularly the financial side of Singapore. I mean, I could do you a lecture, and I have done a lecture on this, on the architecture of the capital of Kazakhstan, Astana, but you really don't want to hear that now, as they try to work out who they are. But it just seemed to me to be soulless. And at the heart of the old colonial district, there's a church, the cathedral. And looking out from my hotel window, I could just see it in the distance. And I thought, I wonder what people see when they look at that. I wonder what they see. Do they see something that is dwarfed by all the towers, and yet it speaks of something so radically different from everything else here, that it just stands as a fairly small witness to a different way of being? See, today is in the Christian calendar is All Saints Day. And in our first reading from Paul's letter to the Ephesians, a circular letter that went around loads of places, we've got the one that landed up in Ephesus, he addresses himself in the first words of the part we had read to all the saints. And I wonder what you thought when you heard that word. Are they just old people from the past? Who are they? Who are these saints? Well, actually, if that letter had been written now and someone wandered into our midst for the Apostle Paul or someone else to read it and addressed all the saints, you'd be sitting here thinking, right, that's us. But we've grown over the centuries to do things like, I was having a quick look at your windows, your glass windows. You see, we stick a plate round their head and they become a saint. And then they become remote from us, don't they? They become the holy ones. They become the ones who get it all right. They probably had their theology worked out. They had all their ethics worked out. They didn't have rows about identity and about stuff like that. Except they did. Just read the Bible and you see it. But we stick a plate behind their head and they become remote from us. But actually the stories of the people who were the first Christians, they're people like you and me. They're no different. They're people who had encountered Jesus Christ, Jesus of Nazareth as they knew him, and they found that their way of going through the world, their way of seeing God, the world, and themselves was radically challenged and changed. they didn't walk up to Jesus of Nazareth one day, you know, when he was wandering around the hills of Galilee and go, oh my goodness, you're the Son of God. I must become a Christian and now I'll go to church regularly and read my Bible. They were good Jews. But they were living under the jackboot of the Roman Empire. If you want to know what it's all about, read Tom Holland's new book, Dominion. Apart from the last chapter, which is just rubbish. I didn't tell him that. I said it wasn't convincing. But the rest of the book is superb, describing how the Christian church began to grow and how it shaped the Western mind. And it didn't do it because it was anodyne or wet or boring or irrelevant or unconnected, disconnected from real life. It challenged and changed the world because it went to the root of what human beings are, how human beings are, and how we live together in community. Did you notice in the reading from the Gospel, it's called the Beatitudes. It's slightly different, but slightly longer in Matthew's Gospel. We had Luke's Gospel. And, you know, blessed are those who are poor, blessed are those who are meek, you know, for theirs is the kingdom of God. And we go, oh yeah. Well, in those days, the people of Jesus' time would have gone, you've got to be joking. Because we know that power and might are right. They work. How do we know? Because if you step out of kilter with the Roman troops who occupy our land, then you're likely to end up on a cross. We know that power works. So your job in life is to accumulate power and protect yourself. And then Jesus comes along and says, well, actually, those who do that now, those who laugh now may weep later. Those who protect themselves now, at the expense of everything else, they're the ones who may be unprotected later. Those who look to their own security now might find that they are insecure later. Because he turned the world upside down. And that was a direct challenge. When you're faced with the power of the Roman Empire and you're supposed to be meek, which isn't the same as weak, when you're supposed to look after the poor and give your life away to support those who are powerless, then that's a bit of a challenge, isn't it? But that is what created this community of what we call the saints. People who said of Jesus, do you know, I don't get it all, but I'm going to come and walk with you. I'm going to follow you. And Jesus said, if you come and follow me, you might end up on a cross. And they go, okay, if that's the deal, but I'm still going to walk with you. And some of the people who set off walking with Jesus then caved in. Didn't quite work, or they couldn't last the course. He never condemned them. In fact, some of the people who came to Jesus and said, I want to go with you, because he's the man at the moment. That's a bit scouse, that, wasn't it? With the man at the moment. He was the man at the moment. There's a buzz about him. You can see why people are attracted by the latest thing. Or he's the one who's going to set us free from Roman oppression. He's going to be the Messiah, the deliverer. So we'll go with him. And then what happens? Reality begins to dig in, and they don't all get it. So at one point, some of them come to him and say, we want to come and follow you, but first I've got to go and, you know, attend to my business. And Jesus says, look, don't start. Don't start for your own sake, based on a fantasy. Don't come and follow me thinking it's all going to be rosy and easy. Don't think it's all going to be orderly, because it won't be. So don't start, because you're just going to be disappointed. He wasn't being cruel. He was being utterly realistic. And Christian discipleship is about being utterly realistic. I remember taking a group when I was Bishop of Croydon to Zimbabwe. And funnily enough, the first day we were there out of this mission station and farm, and we went for a walk. And as we got out into the bush, we heard the noise of a bus, which is a bit bizarre when there ain't a road. And this bus drew near. And as it went past us, on the side of it, it had Croydon Council. They must have bought it on eBay or something, but it was a bit surreal. But before we went on that trip, and it was 2007 or 8, inflation was 10,000%. There were big problems politically. There was no water in Gweru. We knew there were food shortages. We didn't know, I offered to the bishop there to pull out because we didn't want to be a burden. And he said, don't wait until things are good to come and see us. Come and see us while we suffer, then we know you love us. So we went. But there were three, I can only describe them as Surrey ladies, young mums who were going to come. And their husbands got really iffy because they wanted a detailed itinerary so they knew where their wives were going to be all the time. And Africa doesn't work like that. So in the end, I got them and their husbands to come up to our house in Croydon. And I said to them, look, I can give you a detailed itinerary. I can make one up. But I can tell you from the moment we land, it'll be a work of fiction. Because Africa doesn't work that way. And if you can't go with it, if you can't go with the flow, if you can't face the challenges that come as we go, don't come, because you're going to hate it. They all came, and they were the best people, I think, because they faced it before they came. If I just tell you as one example, apart from being hunted by the secret police, we had problems with them. But when we arrived at the airport, the bus wasn't big enough to get 20 people and their luggage in. So someone went out and found a welder. Yeah, and they came and they welded a hook thing onto the back of the bus in the car park, and then grabbed a taxi and shoved some of the bags in that for a three-hour drive from Harare to Gweru. And I said to these women at one point, I said, this is just the beginning. Just go with it. And that's what you've got to do. Now, being a Christian is a bit like that, and that's what the early disciples found. They didn't start with everything worked out. They worked it out as they went. And they rowed and they argued. There's a great bit, some of my favorite bits in the Gospels, Mark chapter 10, when James and John, who we know are called, they've got a nickname, the Sons of Thunder, because they're the big men, Sons of Thunder, Boanerges. And at one point, they come to Jesus on the quiet and they say to him, When you come into your kingdom, can one of us go on your right hand and one of us on your left? You know, the places of authority and prestige. And Jesus says to them, can you drink from the cup that I'm going to drink from? And they go, yeah, of course we can, with James and John, for the Sons of Thunder. And Jesus says, do you know you will, but you haven't a clue what it means. You have no idea what's coming your way. But you will drink from that cup. Anyway, the next verse says, when the others heard about this, they were angry. I want to know who told them. I think it was probably Jesus. I think he probably went past the other disciples and went, guess what James and John just asked me? But you see, there were tensions, they were arguing, and they worked it out as they went. But they followed Jesus for one reason. And I think it's the same for us today. They followed Jesus because when they looked at him and when they listened to him, when they saw what he did, they wanted to be part of a group of people who would defy the ways of the world in which we live. And they would dare to believe that grace and mercy and love and humility might be more powerful than violence, destruction, power, and death. They dared to believe it. They saw it in Jesus as he restored to people, usually women, their dignity and their place within the community. As he offered hope to those who were hopeless. He didn't say sacrifice your brain. He said be realistic and get stuck in and we'll work it out. But he offered a different way of being and a different way of seeing, a different way of thinking about God, the world, and us. I'm a Christian because I realized a long time ago that I needed the grace of God. I can't save myself. I don't need anyone else to tell me where I screw it up. I'm quite good at working out my own inadequacies and failures and failings. I don't need anyone to point it out. I mean, feel free if you want to, but we haven't got long. My major failing is I can't stand Manchester United or Manchester City, but things are good at the moment. When we said earlier, I think, was it in a prayer or something about despair turning to joy or something? I thought, yeah, that was yesterday, wasn't it? We had to win in injury time. But I'm a Christian because I know my need of God. I know my need of forgiveness, of the freedom to start again, and the freedom to be me, knowing that when Jesus looks me in the eye, he has no illusions, no surprises, but I'm free to work it out as we go. Now, look, this morning, and you can tell I'm coming into land now, this morning I'm confirming these wonderful people. And they've all come to this point via a different route that's probably unique to each of them. There isn't a sausage machine that brings you to confirmation. But they'll have come in their own route and their own way. They'll have their own questions. They'll have their own doubts and dilemmas. They'll have a different future ahead of them. We don't know. There are no guarantees in life. But what unites them, and you'll find this when we carry on in a minute, is the need of God's grace and mercy, and that sets us free not to have to hide. It's glorious freedom. And then to be part of a community that dares to live differently. Yes, we'll get it wrong, we'll mess it up, but that's what we're here for. Not just to play the game, but to challenge the rules. So that's what we're about. So in a moment, what's going to happen is they've been baptized. They are marked with the sign of the cross. I'm going to do it to them again. I'm going to look them in the eye and say, God has called you by name and made you his own. Not everyone else, you. And I've said to them, don't bow your head and look at my shoes. Look me in the eye, because I want you to hear that really clearly. And then I'm going to pray that you be filled with the Spirit of God to empower you to live as part of this community in a challenging world. And then they're going to come for communion. And like these young people here, you're going to come for communion with empty hands. So every time you come to church, if you think you're better than everyone else, you're in the wrong place. Right? Because we come with empty hands and we say we need to receive. It's all we can do. We can receive the grace of God. That's what baptism is. You receive it. It's done to you. And then we take bread and we drink wine. It becomes part of us physically. This isn't airy-fairy spirituality. It becomes part of us physically, and we go out transformed, having been fed. And we'll say at the end of the service, I think, send us out in the power of your Spirit to live and work to your praise and glory. In other words, get out. This isn't for in here. It's for out there in the world. And my prayer for each of those being confirmed, those young people receiving communion for the first time, that every time you open your hands like that, you remember that you are empty and you can receive. And that God loves you with a love that is ferocious and will not be watered down or stamped out by whatever the world throws at you.